Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost. Stand alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, we talk about the other pingdemic, parcel delivery tech scams. Who hasn't received one? But what can you do to protect yourself? Also, it's squeaky bum time for the triple lock, but what will Rishi do after wages surged 8.8%? We look at why buying a new car in 2021 is harder than snapping up loo roll in lockdown one. And it's pushing prices for used models through the roof as well. Talking of roofs, the blink and you'll miss it mortgages, plus Nationwide's bribe to get us to sign up. Is this the start of a new current account battle? Don't be getting up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, in what is probably no great surprise to anyone, parcel delivery scam techs have topped the poll. There is a poll for the most prolific smishing scams. Yes, the fraudsters swooped in to take advantage of the rise in online shopping during the pandemic to the tune of almost 500 million that they nabbed off us. But they're still here and in massive numbers. So what can you do to protect yourself? Lee, the former scam man Boyce, remind us, smishing, what is it? How does it work? And what's going on here?
Yeah, so smishing is just a technique that scammers use basically to send out sort of texts and emails portraying to come from a certain organization or business. They want you to click through that link. They want you to enter personal details. They want to get as much information off you as they can. Sometimes these links can have dodgy viruses on and that kind of thing. And it's an epidemic, Georgie, and it's been going on for quite a long time now. And it seems like progressively so, it's getting more and more aggressive as the years go on. And I would suggest that pretty much every person, if you've got a mobile phone or you've got an email address, has had some sort of smishing attempt at them. That might be once a month. That might be getting stuff every single hour of the day. You know, there's a lot of this going on. And almost a decade ago, George, you launched the Beat the Scammers section of our website and This Is Money because we saw where this was all going. We saw that there was a growing need to alert people to these scams and things that were out there. I've gone behind the scenes. I've seen how things like number spoofing work, which is basically where criminals will pretend to send you messages from, say, your bank, and then they can make that text message look very, very legitimate. Because if you're on your phone and you've got your bank name on there and you've got legitimate messages from them, they can pretend to come from that number and people go, oh, it's a message from my bank. And you might click through it because you trust it because it says the name of your bank at the top of that text message thread. I've seen it all. Now, the thing is with these sort of scams is that they sort of go in ebbs and flows of different targets and the way they approach things. So, you know, the big one was banks pretending to be from your bank, because obviously it's very lucrative for criminals to get your personal information and try and log into your bank account and swipe all of your money, or do the impersonation scam where they phone up and say that your account's been compromised and you need to transfer money into a safe account. I like to think that we've written quite a lot about this in recent years, so people get more and more clued up. I think a lot of people have this thing where they go, this will never happen to me. You'd have to be stupid. You'd have to be silly to fall victim to these scams. But it's just not the case. You know, you might be at a low point. There might be something happening in your life in which, you know, for whatever reason, you're stressed or haven't got much time, and you're more likely to fall victim to this. Or you might have elderly grandparents, relatives, friends who are not that technologically savvy, and they're more trusting and, you know, might fall victim to this. So it's all about awareness for me. And that's why we launched that almost a decade ago. So fast forward to now, and in the last 18 months, I mean, it was already kind of going this way anyway, but people are getting way more online deliveries, and people are getting more online deliveries. Probably there's a section of society that had never really had anything ordered to their home before, and they've kind of embraced it. And whether that is getting the food shop, whether that is getting from a giant like Amazon, whether that's using a local company, a local business to get something delivered, we're more likely now to be shopping online. And actually, this data that's come out is from a company called Proofpoint. And basically, it's data provided by UK Finance. This cybersecurity company, Proofpoint, if you get a spam message, you can send it to 7726, the number. You can forward that text on. And basically 7726 on your keypad spells out spam. And they collate these messages that get sent to them to see, you know, the trends and what's happening. And more than two-thirds of texts in the last month of spam texts that have gone through to it have been about parcel delivery scams. I've had them. I bet you've had them. I was with a friend on the train last week and he was expecting a delivery. And I think this is where it gets a little bit murky. You're expecting a delivery and then you get a text message saying that there's a problem with your delivery or they've tried to deliver it and they can't. You might click through on the link, think, well, I was expecting the delivery, so surely this is legit. My advice is be cynical. And I've always said this, be cynical about any kind of text message that you've got that contains a link, any kind of email that contains a link, unless you know you are dealing with the company, 100% you know that, don't click on anything and just take a breath, take a breather and go, hold on a minute, is this the delivery company that's meant to be delivering this? If in doubt, go and log into the retailer that you've ordered from, whatever retailer that is, and see where, track your progress of your delivery if you're that worried. If you click through on these links, all manner of things can happen. And actually, it turns out my friend's message when we were on the train, it wasn't from the delivery company that he was waiting for. And he took his time, he went into his emails, and he checked, and it was a totally different delivery company. But he almost got tricked into clicking that link, and who knows what could happen. And you just got to be cautious, Georgie. You know what will happen. In the next couple of years, people will completely wise up to this, and then criminals realise that this tactic isn't working anymore, and they'll go on to whatever the next thing is. Remember last year, there was quite a lot of spam messages going around about like coronavirus testing and that kind of thing. You might click in a link and the criminals don't care. They don't care that there's a pandemic. They don't care that you're waiting for a parcel. They don't care that you're with a certain bank. They just want your money and they just want to rip you off. And you've just got to be cautious.
Simon, have you had one?
Yes. Yeah, I have. And in fact, funnily enough, I have a work phone as well as a personal mobile phone. And I very rarely actually use the work mobile for telephone calls or text messages. So there's really not that many people who have the phone number. And I don't tend to put it in places in forms and things. I use my personal number. Basically, pretty much the only contact I get on that is from like scammers. I get the recorded messages about, you've been in an accident that wasn't your fault. And pretty much the only text messages I get on it are from parcel scams. At the moment, I had a quick look at my messages yesterday just to check I hadn't missed any, and that was pretty much all there was. And I thought, how funny, considering we're going to be talking about this on the podcast today. But I think the key to this, and actually the key to all scams that are successful in this way, is there a bit of confusion around a situation already? Now, I think that this is where a lot of the banking stuff comes from. The phoning up, pretending to be your bank, fraud, asking for details. And banks say, well, we'd never ask you for that. Now, but banks do regularly change what they ask you for. And it's very difficult to keep track of all the different ways that you have to log into different bits of banking. So if someone puts you under pressure, you think, okay. You know, with the bank thing, they tell you you've been defrauded. And as we've discussed on podcasts before, banks have still never solved this problem whereby they phone you up and say, hello, Mr. Lambert, it's so-and-so calling from X Bank. Or we'd just like to take you through security to verify who you are. And then they ask you some of the details. And if they do that maybe three or four times, they could probably piece together all of your memorable information and all your passwords. And you say to the bank, well, how do I know who you are? Because you've called me and I am me. And it would be highly unlikely that you'd just call me on my mobile phone and someone completely random would answer. But how do I know who you are? And they say, well, we can't really do that. They haven't worked out a system to do it. So there's confusion around the banking system. Now let's take that over to parcels. If you think there's confusion around the banking system, whoa, look at the getting a parcel lottery. I mean, which in the coronavirus pandemic has basically also turned into a leave it on your doorstep and run away game. It's like knockdown ginger, right? I mean, I have had Parcel Force and Royal Mail cards through the door that just say, we tried to deliver your parcel. And then it just doesn't say where it's gone. It's just vanished. They don't say it hasn't gone.
You're
to
lucky to get a label.
Hasn't gone to a, like hasn't gone to a depot. Oh yeah, I've had text messages saying we tried to deliver your parcel. We've left you a card through the door to say where it's gone. We didn't leave a card. They're just it's a very very random service. And I'm going to offer an apology here to any of our listeners who are delivery drivers who are actually doing the stuff that they're meant to be doing. telling people where their parcels have gone and leaving the cards through the door, and say that I'm very sorry that I'm tarring you with the brush of the rogues out there who are on such a tight schedule. I think it's that rather than they just can't be asked. They're on such a tight schedule that they don't do it. But all of this stuff is feeding into the whole, here's a text message. Oh, someone's just tried to deliver me a parcel. I mean, I have sat here in my house at times when working from home, and I have watched someone walk a parcel to the door and then just walk off because I can see out the front of the house. They didn't ring the doorbell. I know they didn't ring the doorbell because I didn't hear the doorbell. And there was an occasion, and that this kind of stuff happens all the time. And then I get a message that says, we tried to deliver your parcel, but you were out. I was like, I wasn't out. I could see you. And again, you know, a similar thing. My wife got one of these DPD things a while back. So, oh, they've tried to, she's like, the bastards. I was in. They didn't ring the doorbell. And she's like, and I was like, well, hang on a minute. Are you expecting a parcel? Which is the wrong question to ask people nowadays. I mean, that's like saying, is the sky blue?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, actually, summer 2021. Is the sky grey? Of course you're expecting a parcel. You're permanently expecting a parcel. But she did say, well, actually, no. I was like, don't click that just yet. That might be a scam. And it was a scam one. So she was, you know, very close to clicking the link. But that's how people click the links. Because I'd have clicked that link probably. I'd have gone, oh, yeah, I probably am expecting a parcel. And I can't believe they didn't ring the doorbell again.
Yeah. I mean, Lee, you were saying earlier about, oh, you know, people are going through difficulties and all that. You don't really. You just have to be going through your daily life. Oh, look, quick, I've just got a text message, bump. And that's why this is so successful and so common, because it's just so easy. How are the banks responding, though, to all of this? I mean, 500 million almost was scammed this way last year, we think. Are people getting their money back?
Actually, one of the big measures that the banks have done in recent years, which, you know, you kind of think, why hadn't this been done before, is matching sort codes and account numbers to people's actual names. So if you're making a payment, you know, the account details all match up. I think that banks have cottoned on way more of this kind of fraud. I remember 4 or 5 years ago focusing on one big UK bank that was really struggling to keep on top of all of these scams and came under quite a lot of criticism from us, and have made changes that, you know, I don't receive anywhere near as much in the way of bank transfer scams over banks as I once did, and other scams in that way, which suggests that they are doing more. I met up with a head of fraud a couple of years ago at one of the big banks, and they've boosted numbers in their teams to spot anything suspicious, to try and iron out any of this kind of thing, which probably suggests why there's been a bit of a focus towards, you know, bank impersonation scams are still rife. There's still text messages being sent. I think it's something like 30% of all spam text messages are still to do with banks. But this is why this focus has been shifted a little bit onto a different kind of scam, to try and trick people in a different kind of way, utilizing something which has become popular in recent years, which is deliveries. You know, I always find it really hard to totally criticize banks over this, because, you know, people fall for it and, you know, might transfer big amounts of money if it's one of these safe account scams. And I have a degree of sympathy. I have a degree of sympathy for all parties, because, you know, we don't ever want to see anyone losing large sums of money. But ultimately, you know, care and caution has to be taken. And banks, I think, are better now at having more literature on websites, on apps, saying, are you sure, before you press go, are you sure this is legitimate? And actually quite a lot now run a message saying, have you been contacted and asked to move money into a safe account? If so, don't click go. You know, don't do this. Call us. And that's the thing. I think the key to unlocking all of this is just awareness. It's awareness and spreading the word and letting people know that there are criminals, professional criminals out there doing this. And I've written about this before, Georgie. I did a really big piece for Daily Mail about action fraud, which is now about to be disbanded because it's just not fit for purpose. And it hasn't been fit for purpose since it launched, and people didn't really understand what it's for. I think I did a story, something like 1 in 500 cases were being investigated properly that got reported to action fraud, which is just crazy. But one of the big problems is a lot of this comes from overseas. A lot of these gangs operate overseas, and then once the money's gone, it becomes very hard to track down. And actually the criminals become very hard to track down, and it takes vast amount of money to go and find where this ends up and to stamp out on all of this. So it becomes tricky. But you know, you talk there about £500 million. I mean, that is a lot of money being lost to these kind of scams. And that's the scams that have been reported. Yeah. So it could be far more than that, because people might be embarrassed that they've fallen victim to this. You know, you shouldn't, as I say, it doesn't take much to have a kind of gap in your armor where you accidentally click it. And let's not forget, Georgie, as well, there's a lot of vulnerable people out there. There's a lot of vulnerable people that just wouldn't understand at all. So you can see how this could happen. So as I said, I think I started this by saying, you know, you don't ever think it's going to happen to you, and I hope it won't ever happen to you, but just think about the vulnerable people that might be in your life, and to tell them, you know, to give them the advice, advice not to click on links, not to give away details. And I know that sounds really simple, but unless we spread the word about all of this kind of thing, it will just keep happening.
I don't know, Lee, you see, because I think all of this, what it requires after awareness, is a enormous dose of cynicism. And I don't know, my mum is one of the most cynical people I know. So I don't need to tell her not to click on things. She just automatically wouldn't do it anyway. But that's the stage I've got to at the moment. If anyone calls me, I mean, literally about anything, I'm like, don't believe it. Why are you calling me? Why are you calling me? How do you know my details? I'm not going to tell you anything. And hang up and end up just not doing anything, which is... that okay, fine. My philosophy, especially with things like delivery, is if it's that important, it will arrive at some stage. If not, I'll get my money back. And if it's through Amazon, they should tell you. But Lee, if awareness is the key, it's not just about parcel delivery ones, just a couple of quick other of the big ones around there, just to be careful. You mean, you mentioned the COVID vaccine ones. I imagine I get quite a lot about iTunes, which is anything. I had an iTunes account. And things like council tax. Oh, no, the one about a TV license, that's a big one.
Yeah, exactly, Georgie. And actually, just to go back to what you were saying there, I treat everything with cynicism. I don't even pick up the phone anymore. Honestly, there's nothing that's ever important enough for me, unless it's like, you know, a family member or a friend. I've just given up. It's usually just automated rubbish, and I just haven't got time for it. But yeah, I mean, the big ones, I would just say the TV licensing one is definitely one that I get quite a lot of. I feel like the iTunes one was like one of the originals, like, you know, back in the day when everyone used to get like iTunes vouchers and things. You know, a lot of us pay like monthly subscriptions now, but that's another one. Monthly subscription stuff, things like Netflix, I get impersonation emails about them all the time, saying that my account's being cancelled or compromised. Same with Amazon. I get constant barraged emails about I've won a £50 Just Eat voucher. I get that probably about 5 times a day, and I think I've used Just Eat like once. All I would say is that if it's a big company, something that's popular, something that you do make payments for, as you rightly point out, TV license, council tax, but just treat it with a big, heavy dose of cynicism, because the safest thing to do is not to click these links, to go away. If you're really worried about your TV license payments not gone through, phone the TV license people and find out. Don't just rely on clicking on a random email. And actually, quite a lot of the time, you can hover over the sender details. Don't click on it, but you can hover over it and you can see where the email address, where it's originated from. Often it's a load of gobbledygook, and you know that that wouldn't be a legitimate, you know, company sending you that. That's actually a really big tip, to see where it's been sent from. But even if it is something like, you know, at tvlicense.com, it still doesn't mean it's legitimate. But, you know, that can be a telltale sign as well, and look out for things like spelling and all that type of stuff. But I was given that advice a long time ago, but I even think now, don't even do that. Just ignore it.
A big tip with the TV license is, it's all right. They'll send you a really nasty letter through the post saying you're going to be prosecuted big red. Look out for that one instead, because they enjoy doing that. So let's move on from this. We could talk for a long time, sadly. But the data is in. The official number that we've been waiting for, wage growth, has just hit 8.8%. Never mind that it's due to the distortions caused by the pandemic, because a promise is a promise. Or is it? Will the Chancellor keep the triple lock as is, which could see state pensions top £10,000 a year Or will they find a bit of a fudge? This is Money Readers are in absolutely no doubt what they think should happen. But Simon, let's just rewind to a couple of podcast past where you were explaining about why we would get this kind of rather large wage growth and how it might not be quite so accurate, et cetera, et cetera. Wage growth, 8.8%. Is it really?
It'd be awesome, wouldn't it, if we were all getting 8.8% pay rises? Look, I think that there's something that needs to be recognised here, and that is that wages are not going up by 8.8%. That is the crux upon which this argument lies. Wage growth figures are being massively distorted by a number of things. The return of people from furlough. Now, you would have thought that people who were furloughed and being paid 80% of their wages by the government wouldn't feature in the official wage growth statistics. Unfortunately, they do. So when they're being taken back off furlough and they go back to up to 100% of their salary, it looks like they're all getting a 25% wage increase, because to go from 80 to 100, you have to go up by 25% of 80. This is an issue. We also have, there was an element where some people took pay cuts that were still in place this time last year, temporarily, and they have now returned to their full wages. We also have an issue where disproportionately those people who have lost their jobs and have been hardest hit by the pandemic are the low paid. So they've been taken out of the numbers, which increases the average overall. So there's a triple whammy going on there. And I think potentially you could add to that another element that might be delivering a quadruple whammy, which is the whole pingdemic truck driver, lorry driver delivery thing going on, where you're hearing stories of basically people who, you know, deliver stuff on lorries and trucks being told, we'll give you an extra couple of grand. Basically, stay with us, don't go to that person. These people are in hot demand at the moment due to there being a shortage of them caused by the pandemic, but also due to Brexit concerns. Due to Brexit, full stop, right? Okay, makes it less attractive for people from overseas to come and work in this country. And a lot of the trucking in this country has been done by people overseas. There's also a lot more paperwork, so people are more reluctant to take the jobs that involve coming to the UK. And there's the whole testing quarantine situation, which truck drivers don't have to abide by the same rules that you have to abide by if you're going on holiday. But all of this adds up to a whole extra bit that means that there is a chunk of people who, and to be fair to them, a lot of these people work very long hours and do a very hard job. And if they end up getting paid some more money, well, good on them. And I hope that that money sticks. What this means, however, is that average wage growth is being massively distorted, and it looks like it's gone up by 8.8%. It hasn't gone up by 8.8%. Most people in the private sector over the past year have actually had a pay freeze. And if they're getting a pay rise this year, it's going to be a pretty small one. However, the triple lock says that pensions will go up by the greatest of inflation, average wage growth, or 2.5%. And average wage growth is currently knocking inflation and 2.5% comfortably out of the park. We've got inflation figures today, 2%. 2.5%, it's obviously 2.5%, wage growth 8.8%. This could bring a bumper state pension increase. And as we've spoken about before, the question is, does the government do something about this, fudge the situation and say, right, we're going to smooth it over a couple of years? The pensioners would still get a substantial increase, even if it was smoothed over a couple of years, to be honest. They'd get a bigger increase than most people are getting in their wages. Or is a promise and you have to just stick to the original formula? The poll on our website has now been voted on by more than 20,000 people. And should the government honour the triple lock if it means a huge rise in the state pension? Yes, currently features 93% of the votes, and no, features 7%. An indication of the row that the government is walking into, hence the reference to squeaky bum time, the famous Sir Alex Ferguson saying, which is about basically when a game could go either way, the clock is ticking down, it's nearly the end of the game, are you going to score a winner in Fergie time? Are you going to score two in Fergie time to come from behind and win or not? And it actually refers not to noises coming from people's bottoms, but to the noise of people squirming around on plastic seats because they're so nervous.
which is sort of from their bottom, isn't it? But not directly. But
I like to think that Rishi Sunak sits at number 11 on a really cheap plastic football stadium style seat.
Yeah. Well, okay, so that's what This Is Money readers think. What will Rishi decide to do? Lee, there's a question between... It's so difficult because there's so many different arguments for this. Because, look, this isn't just for people who are about to get their pension now. This will be for people in the future as well. But, Lee, the other side of the coin that the Chancellor will have to be weighing up, and all the noises do indicate he is going to be looking, I assume, for an alternative than to sticking with the triple lock based on this.
It's a kind of real damned if you do, damned if you don't moment, isn't it, for the Chancellor? And actually, you think about the demographic of the typical Conservative supporter, it's probably, you know, more sort of older, you know, not completely, but you know what I'm trying to say. It's like, do you risk the wrath of a lot of pensioners that expect the triple lock to be honoured, which was, you know, one of the core manifesto pledges? This is a real tricky one, Georgia, though, isn't it? Because you could never have foreseen this kind of skewing of figures. And actually, it's one of those things, the triple lock should have come with an asterisk, with some T's and C's attached. You know, if there was some sort of crazy pandemic, for example, that skewed figures in the future, we could tinker with it. I think, you know, this is completely my own opinion, it's going to be somewhere in between the 2.5% and this 8.8%. I think there's going to be something in the middle to try and keep everyone happy, the younger people, the older people. But there's going to be outcries, whatever happens. And that's why I'm saying it's a damned if you do, damned if you don't moment. At the end of the day, there's a lot of pensioners or people coming up to pension age that think and believe that the system that we've got here is pretty broken. And that we have got one of the poorest state pensions in the developed world. You know, that is one argument on one side. The other argument we've got on the other side is we've, you know, coming out of the other side of a pandemic, we've borrowed huge amounts of money to get us through the pandemic. What happens in future budgets, you know, will there be a return to austerity? There's been a lot of friction between, allegedly so, friction between Rishi Sunak and Boris Johnson. It's been reported in the press in the last couple of weeks. There's so many big decisions to make about the finances of this country. And what happens to the triple lock? What happens to state pension? I need a crystal ball, but we're going to find out this time next month, aren't we, Georgian? I'm sure we'll be dissecting it. And I'm quite excited. Is that bad? I'm kind of like, it's one of those major headaches for a Chancellor where, you know, behind the scenes, it just must be going back and forth.
All right, let's play a game. Give a figure.
5%.
5%. Lee says 5. Simon?
Well, I think the 5% rise would be very generous, but there is a part of me that thinks they might just honour it and just give pensioners the full whack. A lot of readers have got in touch with us about this, and a lot of listeners have got in touch with us about this, complained about, you know, the UK state pension is not a very good state pension, and that also the people who benefit the most from this are not wealthy pensioners, it's pensioners in poverty for whom the money means more. I don't know how you deal with the problem. It is a problem. It is directly related. It involves giving pensioners a very large increase in the state pension based on the financial pain that others have suffered during the coronavirus pandemic, either by, you know, because even those people who were furloughed and weren't working, they did have their wages cut. All people took wage cuts, all people lost their jobs and all those other things. So it's a very difficult thing to deal with. Does Rishi want to be the guy who's so unpopular with everyone because he cut this? I don't know. Maybe you could get someone else to front up for it. New job for Matt Hancock, maybe? Minister of the Triple Lock starts in mid-September?
Simon. But I do realise that you didn't give a figure there, Simon. I mean, you said it could be 8.8%. Are we going for 8.8% from you?
It depends what wage growth is. I think if he goes wage growth might have actually peaked and it might get down to 8%.
Yeah? Okay, you're going for 8. Lee says 5. I'm going to go for last year's figure. What was that? 3.6. Why not? I'm going to be the least generous out of everyone. I'm going to say 3.6%. So we shall see. We shall see. Now, if you've been thinking about replacing your old car, you might want to hold fire and listen up for about the next 5-10 minutes before you head down to the showroom. That's because finding stock of new motors today is about as difficult, says your motoring correspondent, Rob Hull, as trying to buy a pack of toilet paper a week into the coronavirus pandemic last year. Try 3 weeks round my way there, Rob. Orders of the latest models have mounted up. Deliveries haven't arrived. And don't think you can just bag yourself a used car either. Simon, what is going on?
Okay, so to the pingdemic, you can add the chip shortage. There is a global shortage of computer chips. What on earth has that got to do with the price of a used car? Well, the global shortage of computer chips means that car makers can't make enough new cars, and there is more demand for new cars than there is supply, which is something of a turnaround from the pre-COVID times when car makers were struggling to sell said new cars and were making too many of them. It's not actually that demand for new cars has increased that much. It's just that the supply has declined by so much because a car involves lots of computer chips nowadays. Long gone are the days when your car was an analog machine. It is now fully a part of the digital world, and some of those computer chips are particularly complicated. Stuff that powers things like the infotainment and the navigation and some of the more fancy computer functions that the car does for its running. Now, this has actually led to some car makers having to either adopt go slows, reduce hours in factories, essentially just make less cars. And because there's not enough new cars, there's more demand for used cars. Why so? I mean, there's only a certain number of people and there's a certain number of cars, except there's a rate of attrition with cars. With every day that passes, some old cars that are no good will come off the road. Okay, they'll fail an MOT, someone will crash into them, they'll get written off. And that means that people need another car. Now, they might buy a secondhand car or they might buy a new car. But you are losing some of the car pool with every single day that passes. Add to this the fact that in their wisdom, some of the great and good have decided to bring in schemes like ULEZ, which is extending out to the North and South Circular. And there was a story yesterday saying that Transport for London has written to more than 500,000 people warning them that their car won't pass. I had one of those letters for my car, actually, funny enough. I must have been caught on an ANPR and I don't even live in London anymore. But it goes to show quite how many people, as we discussed the other week, who live in London don't realise their car isn't going to pass. This increases the demand for new cars. There's a push for electric cars and so on. Electric cars use lots of computer chips. And so there is increased demand in the used car market, a shortage of supply, and prices are going up. Prices are up quite a lot. Some cars, some brands have seen the value of their secondhand cars rise by about 10% in the last 3 months alone. So it cost you 10% more to buy, you know, pick a random car, for example, from a certain manufacturer that's gone up by a lot. And it's the ones that are in the most demand. And actually, interestingly, there's a ULEZ thing going on where cars can now be advertised as ULEZ compliant. ULEZ compliant cars gone like that, especially around the London area or anywhere in the southeast. Non-ULEZ compliant cars, so ones that are before a certain date in terms of diesels, certainly, they're hanging around. So actually, if you don't need to drive into London or into a city centre and you do need a car and you're thinking, whoa, hang on a minute, how much? Maybe just buy a non-ULEZ compliant diesel, run it for a while and then sell it when everything has died down. But we're also hearing stories from readers. And actually, this is occurring in the US as well. These stories first emerged there, but I've heard some stories here and we've had some reader comments on Rob's article from people saying that they bought a new car and then the dealer contacted them 3 months later and offered to buy it off them for more because they know that they can actually sell it for more used than they sold it new for 3 months earlier. World's gone mad.
I feel quite interested in Rob's story about the number of chips that are used in models these days. Some cars use up to 40 chips, and I was thinking, what do they actually really do in a car? But they do things like, you know, the infotainment screens, automatic parking assistance, airbags. All of these kind of things are run by computer chips. And what's happened? A lot of car manufacturers paused buying parts in the start of the pandemic because, you know, production lines were coming to a halt and all of that kind of thing, and actually chips were being diverted into things like laptops and into games consoles and that kind of thing, where there was a massive, and I think there is even still now, a shortage of laptops. You know, there's a lot of companies that might have had to buy hundreds, thousands of laptops to give to their employees. And that sucked a lot of chips, computer chips, out of the market. And some new cars, you know, there's a six-month waiting list, let alone a wait for the car to come. How long does it take for this backlog to clear, Georgie? I'm not sure. But it just goes to show the heavy reliance now on technology in cars, where once upon a time, none of this would have ever existed. You wouldn't have needed chips for a car. And now we're at a point where some cars need 40 computer chips. I think it's incredible.
Yeah, isn't it just? All right, that's the end of part one. We'll be back shortly after this.
This podcast is sponsored by eToro. And as at This Is Money, we always like to help you learn more. We've got Sam North of eToro to come and answer a quick question for us. Hello, Sam.
Hi, Simon. Pleasure to be here today.
Sam, this week's question, it's about technical analysis, something that people find very interesting, but often say they don't understand. Traders and investors will often hear talk about this. But what is technical analysis?
Technical analysis is an approach to investing and trading where you examine previous price market data to help forecast future potential opportunities. So, for example, traders, investors through analyzing previous charting patterns may then decide to form a prediction of the future price movements. It is important to understand context, though, and when trading from a technical perspective, it's important to think, well, hang on, how is the market reacting right now? So there may well be a previous price pattern that has worked over the last few days, but we've now got a big new fundamental event where it's not going to work as well. So context is key, but in summary, it's using previous price market data to predict future potential opportunities.
Thank you very much. And if you'd like to find out more about investing and trading, you can come to Sam's special webinar. To find out how to join that, go to thisismoney.co.uk/share-investing.
Welcome back. Now, we've been talking a lot about super low interest mortgage products on the pod over the last few weeks. But apologies if you've just been catching up on some of the episodes, because blink and you'll have missed some of those deals. According to Money Facts, the shelf life of a mortgage deal is at its shortage on record at just 21 days before being repriced. That's a drop of 9 days in the last month alone. Lee?
Yeah, it's really interesting this, Georgia, because essentially we've had this sub 1% battle come on from major lenders. So, I mean, sometimes we're receiving information from the Halifaxes and HSBCs of this world where we're seeing rates go even lower. And we're thinking, wow, how much lower can it get for a home loan? 0.83% from Halifax. But what these banks will have, they'll allocate funds. So basically, they'll have a limit as to how much they'll lend at that rate, and then they'll think about rejigging the rate and relaunching it. So at the moment, rates are only lasting 21 days. That's pretty fast, but it can work in your advantage. I saw a broker tweet maybe last week or the week before saying that the buyer was basically going through the buying process. It had taken a couple of months. In that time, the lender had cut the rate something like 3 times. And the broker managed to haggle with the lender to give them the new better rate, which just goes to show that it can work in your favor. And I think if I remember the tweet correctly, it said that it saved something like £6,000 or £7,000 over the term of that mortgage, just because of how much rates have dropped in the last few months. So last year when the pandemic hit, we saw mortgage rates start to go quite a bit higher, especially for first-time buyers. And they still actually face quite a big gap. There's quite a big gap between first-time buyer rates that are fairly high compared to remortgaging rates or home mover rates, which are just absolutely crashed through the basement. So that's what's going on at the moment, George. We're just on the back of this really hot market in which a lot of people have tried to rush through property purchases before the end of the first part of the stamp duty holiday. It's still a relatively hot market. The information that we've been sent by the banks and various other sources is that, you know, there is still a massive supply and demand issue when it comes to homes. There was a story we did yesterday, something like 1 in 10 rental homes last month were to people that had sold their home but hadn't found a new home to buy. So they've temporarily gone into rental accommodation to get that sale through, probably got a record amount of money, you know, amount of money they weren't expecting for that house, you know, because of the hot market, because of the stamp duty holiday. And now they're looking to move on. And it's just been a pretty crazy market out there. And the competition, where there is a strong competition in the mortgage world, there is a very weak level of competition in the savings world. And that balance has been like that for a number of years now.
Yeah. Simon, other facts that are coming out, sort of number of mortgages also continuing to rise, getting up to pre-pandemic levels. What is the situation as well looking like for those with lower deposits?
Well, interestingly, although we've got record low mortgage rates in terms of individual deals, average mortgage rates aren't actually at a record low. Average mortgage rates are actually slightly higher than they were this time last year. And I think that indicates how there's a competition going on between the banks for the best borrowers, but not quite the same level of competition going on amongst the banks for other borrowers. If you want to fix for 5 years and you've got an absolutely whacking great deposit, you can fix below 1%. If you want to fix for 5 years and you've only got about a 5% deposit, you're going to be looking at maybe 4.5% to 5%. So there's a big difference there. But we are starting to see things shift. There are 4,600 mortgage deals available. That's 93% of what was on offer before the pandemic. MoneyFacts said this week that choice continues to improve in the lower deposit tiers, with growth at 90% and 95% loans value, increasing by a further 25 and 22 deals this past month alone. So that's good signs for people who've got less money to put down. It shows that the banks, building societies are getting more interested in competing for their money.
All right, then. Talking about competing, do we have a new current account battle on our hands? We've talked about current accounts quite a lot, it feels. I don't know if it's just because I've switched recently and therefore I'm more observant of the fact that we're doing it. I don't know what it is, but maybe it's because there's some activity going on in this area. Nationwide is on a mission to lure in new current account customers, offering cash bribes of up to £125 to potential switchers. Terms and conditions do apply. I was a bit pausing there because for new customers, I think it's £100, blah, blah, blah. But the point being, Lee, is these absolutely fell off a cliff, didn't they, when the pandemic rolled around? You couldn't really get anything, could you, in terms of switching? Now we're seeing them coming back. Tell us perversely about Nationwide's offering.
It's a bit like a whack-a-mole at the moment, Georgie. Actually, one pops up with one bank and then that disappears and then another one pops back. So I'm not sure we can really call it competition when there's constantly seems to be one that's doing it. But yeah, the Nationwide offer is relatively straightforward. As you say, it's £125. If you're not already a current account Nationwide customer, you've got a savings product or a mortgage with it, you can switch your current account and get £125. But for other new customers, it's £100. You must switch to do this. So that's the long and short of it. It's fairly simple. Now, the reason behind this is because Nationwide has actually been the biggest switcher winner since the current account switching service began in 2014. It has gained nearly 600,000 more customers than it's lost using the current account system. In comparison, the next nearest is Santander, which gained a lot of current account switchers with the 123 account when it was good, 325,000 but actually, Nationwide, for the first time since the current account switching service launched in the final six months of last year, it lost 7,000 more customers than it gained, which is unusual territory for Nationwide because it's been able to attract customers in because it's a building society, because it offers fairly good customer service, because it offers exclusive rates sometimes to savers. And it also has the current account interest on the first £2,000 for the first year. Those kind of little things have done enough to keep it ticking over and making sure that it's always kind of on the right end of the switching battle. But it's obviously made this move to try and maybe reverse this again and become king of the switchers once more. And we spoke about this in the podcast recently, didn't we, Georgie? You're right, we have spoken about current accounts quite a bit recently, but I think it's because Tesco and M&S have shuttered their current accounts. And we had this story where we were talking about Starling and Virgin Money basically being now the new king of the switchers, and how they're quite varying banks. One is an app-only bank. The other does have branches and does have bribes. Starling doesn't have bribes, and it's just basically getting it because it's new and it's got good customer service and it's got a glossy app. So it's actually quite a crowded market at the moment, but banks want you to be current account customers, but they want you to be using it as your primary account, not using it as a secondary account where you don't really do much with it. Perhaps you just tuck a bit of money in there. They want to cross-sell you other products, and that's the whole point of having a current account. Will we see more incentives coming in the future? I think it will continue like this. I think banks actually pay more attention to these current account switching figures than they like to sort of reveal, because if you're at the bottom of that pile all the time, or you were once the king of the switchers and you're not anymore, you're going to be wanting to get back into that top of that pile. So there's always, it always seems to be something on offer for current account customers. And again, as we've said before, it's a big deal for people switching their current account, not for everyone, but for a large chunk of people that don't want to move bank account. The bank's been fine. Their money's in there safe. They've got no reason to complain. So why are they going to move? Other people, they like to play the game. They like to play the system. Every 6 months to a year, might just swap around current accounts because they've got no loyalty to their bank and they don't care and they just want that money. And in a time of ultra low savings rates, who can blame you, George? If you're getting 100 quid and perhaps you're just there for a year, it's 100 quid at the end of the day. It's
not bad. No, not at all. I do want to, before we end it, Simon, just ask a more general, I suppose, question. Given the last two subjects that we've just discussed there, you know, current accounts, all right, not massive competition, but we're getting things sort of back to how they were, you know, mortgages with more of those, lower interest rates for those with big deposits, etc. Do you sense that the city, do you sense that big finance organisations stuff, do you sense all of this is kind of back to business?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that, so basically what happened, and we talked about this when we talked about mortgages on last week's podcast, is that banks very heavily battened down the hatches and put aside large sums of money for bad debts, defaults, etc., both corporate and individual, you know, from small and medium-sized businesses and individuals as the COVID crisis hit and we went into the unprecedented situation of lockdown. And actually, it turned out to be nowhere near as bad financially overall in general as they thought. Individuals have obviously been very badly affected. Some individuals have saved quite a lot of money. And so they're now feeling fairly flush and fairly swinging. And I think that we are going to see, you know, maybe a sizable step up in banking competition across the board in terms of mortgages, credit cards, savings, but also possibly a wave of innovation. I mean, we've got talk of, we've already seen green mortgages and things like that. There's going to be more stuff coming through for green home loans to try and push this kind of green agenda and stuff. That people do. I think the banks will be looking at the what's been going on in the buy now, pay later sphere and wondering maybe we can replace a bit of the credit card money that we don't really make anymore with that. There's a lot of digital stuff. Lloyds, for example, has got a new boss. He put out a new video this week as he started showing what a sort of relaxed, fun-loving, button-down kind of guy he is. Which is quite interesting because apparently old Antonio was known for being sort of very stiff, was very rigid kind of thing. But also there's a big push, I think, for like digital stuff. There's talk about Lloyds trying to get all of its IT and its sort of back end stuff into the cloud. So it's not reliant on that legacy stuff. And as you'll see with some of the new banks who don't have those legacy systems that they're leaning heavily on, they can do quite innovative things with their accounts, things like the Starlings and the Monzos of this world. So I think maybe over the next 5 years or so, we might see quite a bit of competition, quite a bit of innovation.
All right, then, we shall see. And that's it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You could email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to join in the debate in reader comments. And you can vote in the poll, if you like, on the triple lock.
Yeah, why not, eh?
Go on, see if you can get it to 100%. Or 99.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.